This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Photographer Chris Bickford has traveled the world, soaking in different landscapes and cultures, from a walkabout in Australia to the West Coast waves near San Francisco. But for Chris, there's a special kind of serenity that's only found on North Carolina's shore. For more than a decade, Chris has lived in the Outer Banks, and over the years, he has taken photos of that place's shifting sands and close-knit surfing community. He's published a collection of his black and white photographs in a new book. It's called Legends of the Sandbar. Chris Bickford joins me on the program now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Anita. Good to be here.
Thanks for being here. Tell us about your personal history with Outer Banks. It was a place you spent a lot of time as a child.
Yeah, right? I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia. So we would spend 3 or 4 days here and there in the summer. We would usually go and stay at some of the small strip hotels that used to line the beach, very few of which are there anymore. And it was just a great time. I remember just spending hours and hours in the water on a boogie board and, you know, being a little sunburnt, toe-headed kid down there.
And so you went on a roundabout path, but you came back as an adult. Why did you make the choice to come back?
Well, it wasn't really a choice. I kind of ended up there. I'd spent about 10 years after college vagabonding, going back and forth between playing music and being a singer-songwriter and studying anthropology. I never quite finished my degree, but my last chapter before I came to the Outer Banks was in New York City, and I was there for a few years. And a friend of mine said, why don't you come on down here? There's plenty of music gigs down here. Come down here to play. And so I went down there to play music, and the place just really wouldn't let me go. As much as I wanted, when I first got down there. But in the off season, there's not a whole lot of music to play. And so just by chance, I picked up my dad's old Nikon FM2 and started photographing just landscapes around the beach. And that was when I really fell in love both with photography and with the Outer Banks. They sort of happened simultaneously.
So in this book, you really talk at the beginning about the specific history of the Outer Banks, how its topography, its geology, how its location along the coast is really important for understanding that place. Can you tell us a bit about sort of what exactly is the Outer Banks? What makes it distinct?
Yeah, so the Outer Banks is there's a earth scientist named Robert Dolan who coined the term ribbon of sand. And that's pretty much what the Outer Banks is. If you see it on a map, it looks like someone just took a pencil and just drew a little line outside of the coast. And really, it's only about 30 feet deep. And below that is a layer of sand from the Pleistocene era. And as far as the geological understanding goes, and Dolan was the first one to figure this out, that it's only about 3,000 years old. Most people think, you know, this place has been around forever. There are parts of it that are only 100 years old. So it's a very moving system of sand. And were we not to be there, it would be blowing all over the place. It would be just like a ribbon. If you took a ribbon and laid it on a table and blow it, that's how the Outer Banks wants to move, but we've imposed structures on it, so we've kind of stabilized it to a certain extent, which is good in some ways and bad in other ways.
And what is the surfing culture like there? I know, you know, surfing magazines traditionally show West Coast surfers. We think of people in California. I don't think much about surfing culture along the Outer Banks.
Yeah, we're sort of the anti-California. You know, we're the black and white California. it's a really tight-knit group. Most people are from somewhere along the East Coast. It's a bit of a mecca for East Coast surfing because the surf is consistent and because the climate is such that you can surf comfortably year-round, although it's a little bit dicey in January, February. But because it's so isolated and because people have come from so many different places, it's a very tight-knit community. There's a sort of boondock feeling to it where we're all in here together. We've all given up our lives on the mainland to indulge in this passion that we have for surfing. And so we're now in about the third generation of, you know, there are some grandsons whose grandparents served, but there, so we have families now. We have surfing families, and everywhere you go, everybody knows each other, and everybody looks out for each other. Pretty much, it's not. If you go out west, there's a much more, they call it aggro in the surfing world, aggressive, mean, you know, it's competitive. We don't quite have that vibe. We have a little bit of it, but not quite so much on the Outer Banks. People are more likely to say, hey, are you okay? If they run into you, rather than, hey, man, you took my wave.
So you were out there as a surfer before you started photographing. Was there a moment when you were out there that you thought, ugh, I wish I had a camera. I wish there was some way
to
capture this.
Many moments. I can remember lots of, especially late evenings, maybe in the fall or late summer, when I'd be out with three or four friends and the light would be going down and you would just see just this spectral light. And sometimes if there was some humidity in the air, the horizon would be obscured so that it would look like you're just swimming in a sea of light. And I was just, there was one too many times of me saying, I wish I had a camera out here before I tried to bring a camera out.
Well, let's talk about that story. You write it in your book, the first time you decided to venture out there with your camera. It wasn't quite what you expected. And you actually wrote a brief essay that I think you're going to read an excerpt from for us.
Yeah, I'll read it now. It was from the beginning a fool's errand. On a diamond-speckled Outer Banks morning in January 2008, I stepped into a pair of rubber chest waders and walked into the ocean, clutching a $2,000 camera. I didn't mean to go far. I just wanted to get closer. I wanted to capture moments I'd witnessed at the water's edge, moments come and gone and come and gone, with no one to bear witness to them but myself and a few friends. I wanted photographs that could survive the instantaneous. But my enthusiasm got the best of me. High on the visual distortion of a wide-angle lens, I lost perspective and waded too close into a dredging shore break wave whose rip knocked me off my feet and sucked me under. Instinctively, I shot my right arm up into the air as the rest of me took a cold, wet beating. Seconds later, I surfaced, my head drenched, my waders filled with pebbly sand and freezing cold salt water, my camera miraculously unscathed. I had managed to fire off two frames of the wave, both of which remain with me as records, talismans, warnings from my first ill attempts at bringing a vague idea to fruition. That afternoon, I went online and ordered a waterproof housing for my camera. 2 days later, it arrived. Four pieces of molded plastic, four metal clamps, an assortment of buttons, all sealed tight with silicone and O-rings. To think this thing would keep my camera functioning inside a churning, pounding vortex of oceanic fury seemed ludicrous. But, as countless photographers before me have done, I assembled it, slid my camera inside it, latched it up, and took a leap of faith.
That's Chris Bickford, photographer, reading from his new book of photos and essays called Legends of the Sandbar. I love that because it sort of describes the challenge of trying to do this, the fact that you're realizing that this is almost an impossible task, but you still want to do it anyways.
Yeah. It's the impossible dream.
Yeah. Sure. So, but then I'm guessing there are elements of surfing that you can't capture with a photo, that sort of feeling of like, I want to walk into this wave that looks insurmountable. How do you capture that, like the raw emotion that must be present to do surfing, I'm guessing?
I think just having a camera with you at all times helps. With this book, the writing, I think, was a way of marrying images with feeling. Because there's a piece, The Five Senses of the Sandbar, in the book, where I just talk about different tactile and sensory things that we all experience being on the beach. But that's kind of the magic of photography. When you capture it, you capture it. And you don't know why, you don't know how, you just know when. And it's like, this is it. I got it. my fail rate, especially in the water, is 99.95%. Yeah, for every time I click the shutter, yeah, out of 100 and some photos, I might get one good one.
And these are all in black and white. Why did you make that choice? I would think, you know, the water and the light, the blues and the color, but there's something striking about choosing black and white.
Yeah, I always envisioned it intuitively. I always thought of it as a black and white project. And I think if I were to break it down, one part of that answer would be that the history of the Outer Banks is told in black and white. Mostly we have black and white photographs. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of painting or, you know, some of the earlier arts, illustrative arts on the Outer Banks. So pretty much we have old lighthouses, lighthouse keepers, life-saving stations, rescue teams. Those are the photos that line the walls of old institutions and restaurants and things on the Outer Banks. And I think in general, the people that spend a lot of time on the Outer Banks have all that filters into a collective imagination. And I think that was mostly what I was trying to tap into, was a sense of the collective imagination of the Outer Banks. But also, it's a very stormy place, and there's a lot of texture to it, and texture and tonality and things like clouds, those sorts of things, they just show better in black and white because you're forced to look at the tonal differences rather than the differences in color.
We've talked a lot about the shifting landscape, and I want you to talk in particular about one photograph that was surprising to me that it was taken on the Outer Banks. Tell us a bit about this photograph.
Yeah, I took that photograph the day after Hurricane Matthew last fall.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, it looks almost like something that you would see in the Grand Canyon. It has these like sheer, almost cliff faces that rise up along a ridge, and it looks like a stone formation. It looks like it's probably, you know, 1,000 feet tall, and it's probably about 6 feet. And that's one of the things that's really unique about the sand formations on the Outer Banks. And what people tell me a lot is that this looks like something from Yosemite, or, you know, this looks like something from, you know, Ansel Adams, you know, kind of photography. And I always think that the landscape on the Outer Banks is sort of a microcosm. The geology on the Outer Banks is kind of like a microcosm of geology in general, because it happens so fast and it's come and gone so fast, and it's much smaller. So that photo, I climbed up the back of Jockey's Ridge the day after the hurricane, and the whole dune of Jockey's Ridge had migrated about 6 feet into the oak forest. And at the top of the ridge, there was that formation. And I came back the next day and it was gone.
Our listeners can find all these images at our website, stateofthings.org, so you can follow along with our conversation. I want to go now to another photograph that I know has a story behind it, and it has to do with you missing an event that you had wanted to go to.
Yeah.
Describe this photo to us and then tell us the story.
So I lovingly call this photo Inauguration Day. It's a photo of seagulls flying a few feet above the ground on a snowy day with a old Outer Banks beach cottage in the background on a very dark, stormy, blustery day. And it was actually taken on Inauguration Day of 2009, which was, by all accounts, as we know, a very historic event. And I had wanted so bad to get up to D.C. to be there, to capture it, to see, you know, the history unfold of the first African-American president being inaugurated. But logistics just got the best of me, and I couldn't make it up. So instead, I went to some friend's house. We were watching it on TV, and we just got hit by just not a terrible snowstorm, but a pretty significant snowstorm. So we all went outside and started taking photographs. And yeah, I ended up down on the beach with a bag of sun chips lying on my stomach for about an hour till I got that perfect shot right there. And I always think that it it describes the feeling of the day just as well as any photograph I could have taken if I had gone to D.C.
There seem to be a lot of parallels between the kind of patience, commitment, dedication, trying and failing of photography and of surfing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, there's a high fail rate. You have to wait a long time for the right one to come. And you have to constantly be shifting your position in accordance with what you perceive to be the changes that are happening around you to get just in the right spot at the right time to catch the wave at the right place or to, get the right photograph. So, I never really thought about that, but it's true, yeah.
So this book is definitely capturing a specific place at a particular moment in history. And the Outer Banks is changing, has changed since you've been there. Can you talk a bit about the changes that you have seen, both in the culture and the landscape itself?
Yeah. When I was a kid, there wasn't a whole lot there. There was just starting to be a certain infrastructure of what they call now Hamburger Alley of Pizza Huts and McDonald's and things like that at one part of the beach. But there were long stretches of beach where there was nothing. And I moved down in 2000, which was about the middle of the development boom, starting about early 1980s. Development in the Outer Banks just started to uptick rapidly. There's probably about five times as many people now living on the Outer Banks as there were in the mid '80s. So just to give you an idea, and with that has come a huge amount of development. Giant houses being built that have 10, 12 bedrooms in them and cost over $20,000 a week to rent. Some of the really charming old oceanfront restaurants and nightclubs, the Atlantis, the Carolinian, many, many places that had a real Outer Banks charm to them have gone. Hmm. They've been bought up and there's either condos or rental machines put down there in their place. So it's lost a little bit of that charm. And I think in the book, I tried to ignore that to some degree.
Well, you don't ignore the loss of landscape, though. There are images that show the erosion along the oceanfront.
Yeah, yeah. There's one photo in particular from 2015 that shows the road in Kitty Hawk about 20 feet above the beach because we had a series of two back-to-back two-week nor'easters that almost took out the road. And actually, Hurricane Matthew did take out that piece of road last year. And I like to say that it's not really erosion. It's just barrier island movement. It's just the mechanics of barrier islands. This is the way they work. And we built our human infrastructures on top of them without realizing how these islands move. And now we're paying the price and we're just buying time. We re-nourish the beach. We rebuild roads. We build bridges where inlets have been breached by hurricanes. But sooner or later, actually sea level rise is going to be the best of us. It's going to take over.
Well, we have to leave it there. I guess you'll be surfing until that moment happens. My guest is photographer Chris Bickford. His new book of essays and photos of the Outer Banks is called Legends of the Sandbar. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find out more information about his book at our website. Just ahead, a cookbook that brings Caribbean food memories to American kitchens. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.